So basically, I was always never comfortable when I was on the slopes, and I was like overcorrecting and just crashing into kids and stuff like this. Like the worst person ever on the slopes, you know, terrible thing. Anyway, we are live, everybody. We're live, folks. It's Bringing Food Live on air. Welcome. It is episode 97. We are bringing it to you every Friday, and I'm super excited today because we've got a tremendous show for you and some amazing guests. I think every single person on that's coming on today themselves would merit like a one-to-one session because they've got so many interesting perspectives to share. But I thought I'd just get all of the heroes in one go, like a kind of a Marvel superhero type of show. And it's going to be a really exciting one because we're talking about DE&I from a slightly different angle. How do we get it out of HR and into the business? How do we get more people outside who don't specialize in HR actually caring about it and feeling comfortable with leading it and, you know, operationalizing it throughout the business? So it should be a really fascinating show. But before we kick off, we always have to check our sound systems. So if everyone can hear me okay on Crowdcast, please say hello, give me a yes, no, maybe on that. We are multicasting, folks, so we should be out on LinkedIn also. Are we out on LinkedIn? I've got no clue. If you are, can you please just say hello? Because it would be rather good to know whether it is going out there. I suspect we're not, actually. That's really annoying. I have to say I have no idea what I'm doing, which regular viewers would know already. but if you can't hear me on LinkedIn, please say hello. I've got a yes there. Perfect. It's out. I'm going blind, folks. What can I tell you? And we're out on Facebook as well, which I can monitor. So if you're on Facebook and you're watching this, please say hello. Give me a thumbs up, thumbs down. Let me know that it is okay there. All right. Listen, that's fantastic. We should be ready to roll. Quick word for our sponsors today. We've got a new sponsor who's absolutely appropriate for this episode. It is Applied, folks. Applied are an assessment program which removes unconscious bias from your recruiting process. Award-winning product. Candidates love it. It's one of those products, I think, from the UK that's really got potential to go much further and in the international space. So if you haven't heard of Applied, you should certainly check them out. If you want a demo, you can check it out on the link right here. Link share in the chat stream. Do check it out. Okay, let's move on. Gary, I'm delighted to welcome you to the show. Gary, in fact, people who maybe don't know you, quickly introduce yourself, who you are and what do you do?
Yeah, thanks, Hun. Great to be with you all again today. I always feel bad when you bring me on. All I can think about is Adam Gordon. That's all I can think about.
Upgraded, man. He's upgraded.
So my name's Gary Turner. I work in corporate. We'll have a chat about that today, but that's not the point. I'm actually the vulnerability guy, somebody that really believes in bringing more humanity to the workplace, and that's why this topic's front of mind for me, Hun.
So. Yep. Perfect. And great to have you on the show because you're actually a really good example of what I mean. Like someone who isn't in HR, like you work in the business development angle, but you're very, very prominent in driving all of this, both inside your business and also into the wider community as well. And I'm just thinking that's really good. And that's really cool. That seems to me like a positive thing. How can we do more of that? So loads that we can learn from you also. But you actually have a job, don't you, Gary? You have a job to review the newsletter. So have you read it? And what was interesting last week?
Yes, I did read it, Hun. I've actually got four things that I don't know how much time you want to spend, but I'm going to start on the first one, which was, are all stories are wrong, but some are useful?
Right.
And I thought that was really, really interesting, Hun, from the point of view and linked to this DEI conversation. Do we actually realize that we are literally every day and every moment literally living with stories? Like nothing's fixed. Like I don't think we always take that into account when we're like journeying along.
You know what? This is an extraordinarily well-written post. And he's a really good author. I think it's called kind of Neil Kakar, something like that. I forget his name. But I've just shared it in the channels there. Definitely please read this because there's two elements why I think it's important. Number one, we have to understand that we get narratives all the time and we prefer narratives, which is why we fall for stories, we fall for disinformation. We're kind of all in our echo chambers, Reason why is because we love stories that have explanatory power, and we prefer that rather than the messy reality that it is. Like, oftentimes it's a mess. There's no like real conclusions sometimes you can draw from it. We're not comfortable with that. We need a simpler story. Boom. Therefore, we're susceptible to this. So from a society point of view, we need to be aware of it. But from a kind of a TA point of view, recruiting point of view, it's actually really interesting about how we represent our businesses and talk about our job opportunities and things like this. Like, if we're aware of the nature of storytelling, hopefully we can pick up some of those principles and be better at communicating with people that we want to attract to work with us. So I think a must read for any EB person or anybody writing content or producing content of any type. Share it in LinkedIn. Okay, cool. What else, Gary?
We've got to have a bit of a laugh this Friday. The LinkedIn alternate universe.
Alternate universe, yes. Why was this interesting, Gary?
Well, to be honest with you, I think it's a great thing about storytelling again. Like, each one of those posts that's included is just somebody's perception. Yeah, right. It's not necessarily true. So if I use the one with Gary Vaynerchuk, there's quite a damning, like, here's another psycho. But then I'm thinking from a TA point of view, actually. Do you really want to keep that person that's high performing but pisses everybody off?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
They probably should go, actually. So, like, I found it a really interesting sort of tension as I read that article, if I'm honest.
It's so tension-filled, isn't it? So this is just to give you a bit of context, folks. This is a LinkedIn piece written on about LinkedIn by someone who doesn't use LinkedIn a lot. And he or she, I forget the gender of the author, but that person basically was a skeptic, and they characterized the types of characters you can see on LinkedIn. And when they presented it in such a way, not only did you recognize these people, but you kind of thought, oh my goodness, am I doing one of those things? It's like, that's me. And you think, oh my goodness, what's going on? But really interesting, I think, for humor reasons, always good to have a good morale booster to read. But also to be aware that LinkedIn is an alternative universe. It is the recruiter bubble. Most people are not daily actives on LinkedIn. We are. Recruiters, are you daily active on LinkedIn? Let me know. Hands up if you are. Anybody with their hands down, I know you're lying. But everyone else, like a normal civilian, they're not logging on to LinkedIn, like never. The only time they might be is when they're looking for work. So very episodic for them, where for us, we're in it all the time. And that trains our mind in a certain way. So definitely our recruiter echo chamber. What else, Gary?
I've got two more, Hung. The one I'm really interested in was the building a brand ambassador program isn't as difficult as you might think.
Okay.
And you know what I really took away from that, and I think about my own organization, Hung, is we've got tens, hundreds, thousands of people that can all be that brand ambassador, but how silenced do they generally feel in a regular day-to-day context in their organization? I think there's a huge potential to leverage that, but I don't think many corporates do, certainly if I speak from my corporation.
Right. And this is actually written by a brain fooder, Alex Herr. I got to know Alex through the Brain Food Tribune, actually. So that was a good way for me to get to know him. But he wrote this post about how to activate your employees to be ambassadors for your business, again, outside of HR. So a very similar kind of vibe in a different angle, where, you're trying to get an idea out of your department, because it doesn't really work by staying in the department. It has to be operationalized in the wider business. And I thought I like this post because it had some practical tips. It didn't try to solve every issue with referrals or being ambassadors or whatever. It didn't try to solve all of those things, but said, hey, here's ABC. You could probably implement those and it could incrementally improve what you're doing. So well worthwhile to check that out as well. Okay, final one.
Final one, and I think the perfect lead into today's discussion is the amazing post from Chloe Valdery around selling skeptics on DEI. Right. And I just want a perfect frame into our discussion today. How often does DEI talk about love and compassion as part of their strategy? And that just blew me away. I was just like, I talk about love and compassion and connection all the time. But with DEI, there seems to be this tension between, I don't know, a bit of shaming versus trying to get the job done. And I just found that a really interesting tension. So that's what I'm sitting in as we go in to learn today in this discussion.
You know what? That's a really, really powerful way to describe that. So I came across this person through someone shared. I was aware of this lady, Chloe Valdery or something, US author. But yeah, she's coming at this DE&I challenge from a non-combative or adversarial approach, right? So I think a lot of the most of the times when you see it, it's like, it is a little bit, okay, this is a problem, we're going to fix it. If you're not sort of supporting it, you're a problem yourself, get out of the way or whatever, you know, it kind of combative. And sometimes necessary, because you might need to push through at times, right? Particularly on persistent issues that have always been there. Sometimes you've got to break the old system. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a worthy argument. But what this lady is there, Chloe, is essentially saying, that's all well and good, but unless the person advocating for that is coming from a compassionate place, it actually doesn't land. So it's a pragmatist argument as to why it doesn't actually work by just lecturing people. And we kind of know this already. Like there's some good research about the inadequacy of training in DE&I. It's considered to be previously a good idea. Loads of research come back to say, hang on, lots of people are actually very skeptical of this, and they end up being like very, very cynical about it after having gone through a training program, and maybe that's not the best approach. And it's similar about this idea of, you know, you got to try and include them into the inclusivity, I guess, is maybe what Chloe is trying to say. But anyway, she writes it. It's an article about her. She didn't write it, but it's well worth exploring. She's on Twitter as well. So if you need to know more about this person, follow her there. She doesn't need me to reinterpret what is being said. I think another voice that's worth thinking about and following here. Okay. Let's go to the topic at hand. Topic at hand is, how do we get DE&I out of HR and into the business? Gary, I want to, before we bring on our guest, I want to just ask you the question, because this is, you've got personal experience on this. How did it happen in your case where you became a person that, where this is important for you in your business? And how did it happen? Like, why is HR not actually owning this in your company?
So there's two things I have to do. Unfortunately, the corporate, I'm not representing my company job. We're still in that world, unfortunately, but this is me speaking. But I do work in an organization that's publicly traded, Hung, and there's 90% senior leaders are white and male. And that's a public stats. There's nothing, but we're a 50-50 gender mix. That is endemic from pretty much every company I speak to, whether it's inside or outside of my industry. And I think it's really, so I'm personally really passionate as a white male to have this conversation more often. Now, I don't know everything, far from it, but I know that I've got responsibility to be in the space helping that conversation happen, because we've got the evidence, Hung. Like, we know that diversity, improved diversity drives better performance, but there's the change is snail pace. So what's the gap? And that's what I want to learn from your guest today about. What is the gap between, we know that better diversity drives better outcomes, but it's not happening. So why not? And that's what I'm really keen to bust down.
Yeah. And, you know, it's good to have a little bit of that context, Gary. And part of the why not is my conjecture, which could be incorrect. I've just, you know, had this idea and thought, yeah, maybe that's the problem. I have kind of said that part of the problem is HR owns DE&I as a natural kind of way, as it might have been. That's problematic, because it ends up being like I compared it, I think, to marketing trying to own social media, for instance. And when that happened, it basically killed it stone dead, because everyone was terrified to do anything on social media when you're representing your business, because, I'm like breaking through, sort of treading on toes or not obeying the corporate policy or whatever it is, and suddenly you're more or less like dormant on as a marketing force in those social spaces because of that level of ownership. And my conjecture is that HR has the same relationship with DE&I. Now, is that the case, would you say, Gary, or am I wrong in that, or how does it apply when you put it to your personal experience?
My personal experience is that it's a secondary item. It's as simple as that. It's not front and center. We do not design organizations around recruitment. We don't design organizations around DEI. They are all bolt-ons. We design organizations around power and making money. And there's nothing wrong in and of itself, but we get what we design for. And if we're not designing for DEI, we don't get it. It's a massive design flaw in my summary. That's my summary message.
That's fair enough. Yeah, so it's basically what the objective of the business is. And, you know, what it's interesting that we're having this conversation, because 5 years ago, it wouldn't be controversial to say, yeah, you know, the purpose of this business is to make money. That's it. And it's the overwhelmingly dominant view. And, you know, you'd be an aberrant person to describe a different view to that. But it seems that the conversation has shifted over the last 12 to 18 months or so, where maybe, you know, profit optimization isn't the end goal for businesses in the same sense. Okay, before we bring in, I'll bring on Africa and Jesse first, because they're also like managers in the business that aren't HR, but, you know, they do stuff that is diversity related. I want to hear about that. But tell me about how it works. Again, I don't want to sort of say anything about different corporations or whatever, but what have you found as a person that cares about this, but actually has a day job that isn't related to this? It's not a bullet point, and you are not assessed on this as a manager in BD, right? So how does it work when you care about DE&I, but it's not actually, you know, a task that you need to do as part of your employment?
It's a really great question. It's hard. It's hard. And it's not a metrics thing. It's not about it being in your performance review. It's not, you know, DEI, I do genuinely believe, is everybody's job. Like, we have a responsibility to be human, to see each other, to hear each other's stories. So I want to tie that story piece together again. I think we design organizations for busyness and making money. And there's nothing wrong with making money. That's an outcome. But we're not being intentional about how we come together and organize so that we drive brilliant processes and organizational cultures, knowing that we get better. Even we can make more money. We make more money by being more diverse. So what's the gap? And that's the bit I can't get my head around. We make more money by intentionally designing for inclusion, but we're not doing it. And why not? Is my challenge.
Well, let's no pressure to the guests that are coming on. We don't expect anybody to deliver the results, and here's how you do it. But let's bring some of the voices on, because it'll be interesting to see what they've got to say on it. So I'm going to bring on Jesse. She was, by the way, if you saw our onboarding show a couple of weeks ago, Jesse was on that. And it'd be brilliant to bring her back on. And I think we're going to get Africa Munoz on for her debut on Brave Food Live. So let's do that and see whether this works okay. But yeah, like I say, I definitely see myself as someone from the forward and everything, right? So maybe it's turning into a generic excuse for my incompetence. Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing. Take better responsibility for it. Oh, there they are. Amazing. Okay, great to see you two. Let's do some intros firstly. Jesse, let's go to you first. Can you say who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Jesse Allison. I'm engineering manager at Ecosia. Ecosia, it's a search engine which plants trees.
It does indeed. And you should check it out, because you know what? If we're hating on Google and stuff like that these days, then you should just check out a alternative search engine. There's plenty of them out there. And Ecosia have basically baked in sort of ecological awareness is a big part of what they do. How about you, Africa? Can you introduce yourself, who you are, what it is you do?
So my name is Africa. Actually, I have the story behind. So if everyone wants to know why my name is Africa, you can contact me on LinkedIn, because I actually work for LinkedIn. I am a customer success manager. So what I do basically is to work with HR teams and HR departments to bring on new initiatives and strategies when it comes to, of course, recruiting and everything related to HR.
Amazing. Well, listen, thank you so much for both of you for coming on. We wanted to bring on like a diverse set of people from different type of functions within business. And the reason why I wanted to bring you two on first is because the premise of the show is, look, we need to get DE&I out of HR. Let's talk to some like business managers that are actually caring and doing stuff regarded to the DE&I, but aren't officially HR people. So you two are both, I would say, fit into that description. Tell me about how it evolved in your business. Did you need to have a conversation with HR? Was there a DE&I person that you needed to negotiate with before, you know, this happened? Or what was there, like, some sort of structure that facilitated the possibility for you to step into this role? Or is it still like an informal thing you do? It's not like necessarily part of the description. How about we go with you first on that, Africa?
Okay, cool. So I think that it's kind of formal and informal, I'd say. So the structure is there for you to be able to take over, you know, the diversity and inclusion initiatives, but definitely it's up to you how far you want to go. Like, one thing that I want to maybe to call out first, and I think coming back to what Gary was saying, no? So how do we get diversity and inclusion out to the business? Basically, we need to have the diversity and inclusion initiatives firstly aligned to the business. So when I work for LinkedIn, everything is like the culture of inclusivity is embedded in everything that I do. So of course, and then we have the structures, of course. We have, for instance, the first time actually that I started to know more about this topic and being interested on this topic was because I joined the one of the employee resource groups, the Women at LinkedIn group. And of course, I didn't have any clue. Like, I was just joining the group for the fun, to be honest. Like, you know, they were doing cool stuff. They were organizing events. So I thought, yeah, why not? Like, I would like to lead this for the Madrid office, for the Spanish office. So yeah, so I kind of, you know, started knowing more about diversity and inclusion because there was an structure for that. You know what I mean?
Let me just again. I'm going to play sort of the essentially. Let's try and educate everyone at the base level here. So there was essentially a group which you called what exactly? A representation
woman,
group.
Woman at LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm. So this was an informal group of people from different sort of levels of hierarchy. It was literally to say, look, here's a demographic that want to get together and help promote and support that demographic. Isn't there a term? What's the term for this in the corporate world, Gary? You know, it's like there's a description for anyway. Anybody who does know, please let
employee
me know.
Employee research groups.
Yeah.
Employee research groups. Okay. Cool. So you're saying that the employee research group at LinkedIn was a gateway for you to do it. So presumably for non-HR specialists, this may be a route. So the presence of these groups could support that journey in. Okay, cool. How about you, Jesse? I think slightly different in your situation, but again, I'm presuming I don't know every single detail of the journey there, but you lead a lot on the DE&I stuff in your business now and before, I believe. So how did that work? How did that happen? Was that something that was structured or what?
So first, why personally I'm a lot involved in D&I is that I used to be on the other side. I was a software engineer, obviously in the minority or underrepresented group. And I've faced I know what it's like to be in the underrepresented group. So when I moved to a manager position, I wanted to make sure that anyone joining my teams and my company in this case, Ecosia, would not have to face what I had faced in my career. So that was really important for me. And I was very lucky because when I joined Ecosia, there were already a lot of things that were happening, but no structure around that. That was really coming from the employees who were really having a hurt to make sure that everyone joining would feel fairly treated, treated equally like anyone else. But obviously there were no real structure around that. So there were some different ID topics coming from there and there. And when I joined, I started to try to formalize that a little bit more. And we, after hired a head of people who had also an experience leading D&I topics. So that was also very helpful. So that was one of the requirements we had to help, in fact, shaping that. And we really have a both side approach because obviously the D&I topic started from the employees. So we could not just hear it them. That just didn't make sense to say that suddenly is the D&I is under HR. That just doesn't make sense. So what we discussed is having, and this is something that I lived in a previous company. Unfortunately, when the ideas and the work comes only from employees, it does not live long. Because you need to have the buying from your business, you need to have the buying from the CEO, because they are the ones shaping the culture in a sense of your company. So what I wanted it was really to have something that is still honoring what the team and Ecogen are doing, but with a bit more structure and the support from the leadership. So we have this D&I sponsorship group with the leadership in it, and with me as expert manager in middle D&I, and we have also a D&I working group. And this is a rotating group because we consider, as Gary was saying, everyone should embed D&I. So the best way for them, for Ecogen to feel embedded and to embrace the topic is also to make them part of it. So we have this rotating group, and I think it's every quarter they're changing. They have this dashboard, and there is a handover plan between every change. And if people want to stay, that's good. But we don't want either that to take too much of that time, since it's still volunteer work on the side. But that's how we work basically at Ecosia at the moment.
I was going to say, actually, Jesse, like, the rotation sounds great. My question you answered actually was, is it a mandatory thing? But it's a voluntary thing, right? So you're not forcing everyone to rotate through, or sometimes you can do that. And I wonder, you know, maybe it's my kind of like authoritarian streak a little bit. I wonder whether you do just, you know, force people to do it. But you're saying that what is required, so this is emergent, so it came from the people upwards at one point, but it requires the company to ultimately create some sort of structure in order for that to be persistent. Because if it's just the one person doing it, then it's going to last for as long as that person has the energy to do it, and last for as long as that person is in the business. They may depart, and then, you know, you're back to square one. So I like that sort of where we're at. There's maybe a sign there that the maturation of the business has a big impact, because Africa, LinkedIn, obviously more established business and much larger with resources. I wonder whether as the companies get bigger, you might sort of get access to those more structure earlier. Whereas your very young companies like Ecosia, obviously everything's from ground up. You got to just patch and fix as you go. Super interesting. Okay, so what is the conversation with HR at this point then? Again, I'm thinking HR must have like their own initiative, right? Or their own vision as to what they're doing. And then suddenly, you know, you see different departments or different people doing great initiatives. Like, how do we handle that conversation? Is it an easy conversation to have? You know, maybe my entire sort of perception of it being a difficult conversation is erroneous. Thoughts on that?
I don't know if you want to go on that. I think that, like, in my case, to be honest, it's not only a conversation with HR. Like, I have conversations with other employee resource groups. I have conversations with my manager. I have conversations with... So I'd say that for that, you have to have a clear strategy and then cascade. And then what I think it's key, if you want to, in this case, the topic is how to get out of HR. You want to give the freedom. You really need to give the freedom to the employees to do stuff. Like, I'm not told what I am supposed to do every single month, but I'm equipped with the knowledge, with the tools, and with the strategy. We have some pillars that we know we have to follow. We know what is expected from us. And then we deliver. But the way we deliver, and that's why I will say, like, how far you want to go, that's up to every one of us. You can just, you know, do a couple of things and that would be fine. Then if you want to really dedicate more time of your time, you can do that. And one thing that I want to mention as well is that, and it circles back, because for instance, in my role, if I have a conversation with my manager about my OKRs, then diversity and inclusion is included on my conversations. And I explain to her what I'm going to do and what is the impact of that initiative. So, you know, it's not only HR. I think it's, again, a thing that has to be shared among probably the whole company, I'd say. I don't know. Jesse, what do you think about that?
Wait, I totally agree. I think D&I, it's not, again, not an HR topic, simply because we are all employees and we are all benefiting from D&I. We are all benefiting from feeling included in the company and respected and heard. So why should it only coming from HR? That I would expect that from my manager, and I would also expect that from my direct report to respect me and to treat me fairly and to trust my work, even if I'm not part of the overrepresented group. So that's why I think this is weird to think that this should not just be an HR thing. It's just a human thing. I think it was in the comment that was saying, but it's just being human, and that's true. It's just embedding the rehumanizing the work. And that's why for me, that's never has been a HR topic, because first it's literally impacting my life on first stage. So obviously I don't think that this should be something that a department discuss and decide without having the people who will be working with me every day having any clue or any idea on how to do that. And they should be aware on how to be more inclusive and to how to embrace the diversity. So And like you, I have also D&I OKRs for myself, for my department, and for my team. So this is something that this is just obvious, in fact, for me. But I have to admit, I'm very lucky at Ecosia. Again, that came from the Ecosian themselves. So I'm in a company who take that very, very seriously from the groundwork.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is... It's great to have these conversations. And I think we're all generally aligned in terms of it's a great idea to have empowered employees take ownership, and great that there's freedom of action, for instance, as you mentioned, Africa, that people can go ahead and do these things. I just want to, and this may be outside of everyone's experience here, but I suspect it's not outside of other people's experience as well, where that culture isn't there at that moment. You know, some of the older businesses out there, you know, they're not tech companies, let's say, they've been around 100 years. Obviously, there's so much cultural legacy of a business being around that period of time. And guess what? HR does own it there. How would you go about, like, getting it out of HR? Like, what's the negotiation? Is it something you just decide to do a few things on the side and hope you get away with it, and then do more if you do get away with it? Like, what is the technique to get to that point? Any thoughts?
I mean, we can have to start Africa. Go
ahead. We're taking turns. So I think that, and I think the comments are pointing at the same direction. I think to have the buy-in from the leadership, it's key. Like, if I feel empowered to do things, if I feel like, and even I have the OKRs, and I have metrics on my performance review about D&I, it's because the leadership has had the buy-in. So I think that's the first thing you have to do, like, to have the buy-in. And it doesn't have, like, and I work with a lot of clients and with a lot of projects, and it's always the same story. You have to have the leadership buy-in. And how do you get it? It's difficult, but talk business. Like, what's the impact of the diversity and inclusion initiatives? And Gary mentioned, like, the advantages of having a diverse employee base are huge. So work on that and work to fix problems. So if you are just working on a D&I and you don't have anything to show after, I don't know, maybe a year, then probably they won't take you seriously. But if you have fixed something and you can show to the business that you have solved a business problem, then you have the buy-in for sure. Like, it's all about the money, right? So we are working for companies that make money, and that's okay. As Gary was saying, that's okay, that's fine. And another thing, of course, is to work on the, let's say, the culture base. And that's why I love the article that you share. What was the name? Sorry, I did have it here. Like, the theory of charming. Sorry, I don't remember the name. So to have that, like, to have employees that care about other employees, that was the base of LinkedIn. Like, when I joined LinkedIn, I was amazed by the fact that I was able to call anyone, regardless their role, the team, or whatever, for a minute or an hour of their time. And that's because the base, the culture, was about caring about other people. So empathy, all of these abilities that actually were mentioned on the article are key to drive this success. Otherwise, again, you are going to hit to a wall.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go to you in a bit, Jesse, but I just wanted to highlight that one point where maybe there is, you can't just like work on an endless D&I initiative, right? There has to be some sort of like show something, even for your own kind of motivation. So if you have this huge project or this huge vision, that's great. But let's like chunk it down into something that actually can be deliverable within a time frame. Organize these deliverables and get it out there. So a bit of project management, a bit of understanding of, you know, other people might need to see some evidence of outcomes as well. And those types of things, I think, can help build the gravity of the movement, right? How about your experience, Jesse? Have you got any examples of such a project? I mean, I'm like, it's a great abstraction, Hung, but what is an example of such a project?
Well, I've been in a company who didn't get the buy-in from the leadership at start. And I think Cathy could also talk about that experience. We were working together. And one of the questions was how to get the buy-in from the leadership. I remember that we started with a small group. And one of the comments was, why is D&I important for us? And that was one of the topics that was discussed inside the team of employees, and we came up with some ideas where we wanted to focus, why it was important, how we could bring also more people inside the company, but also attract maybe more customers. So having like a business case out of it. And we started to work from there, and we got help from the HR team because the HR team was the D&I owner of the D&I topic. And after a while, they were like presentation of what was done on these different projects to the leadership so they could understand. And that you get the buying or not, at the end of the day, I think what was important was that we regroup everyone. And as you were saying, Africa, there were this connection of we're all in there together. We're human. We're just reconnecting with each other. And that was, I think that was something that was quite important. And one of the projects that we had that I quite like, and I'm trying, and I'm thinking of maybe redoing that also at Ecosia, was we had this diversity lunch where we're inviting people for lunch to present a topic on diversity, what they did, what they changed, why it's important on specific topic, and just bringing awareness and connecting people through this story. So we're talking of the power of storytelling. Gary was sharing this article. That was really this idea of you reconnect, and then people can start to understand why it's important for us, D&I, and why we need to make that a more conscious effort. But I really like also on another topic, I really like this example, and that's an article that really struck me. It explained how the, I don't remember if it was a head of people or a chief diversity officer from eBay who just came with the simplest idea ever. It would just put everyone in a room and just ask everyone to share a story when they felt like they were rejected for who they were. And just that, just sharing again a story and just telling, well, this time in high school where you were made fun of because of your hair color or whatever, try to imagine what it's like when you face this situation every single day. And that just create a connection that does not necessarily exist otherwise. Or that just create this you need to have sometimes felt it to understand it, and you're going to create a connection this way. And I really like this example. I can find the article and share it if I find it again.
Yeah, Jesse, and you're now mandated to go and find an article and share it. Because it's such a great example, isn't it? It's an example of like how you create empathy. Like we talk about these words, but I fear a little bit they've turned into abstractions a little bit, and we say, yeah, be more empathetic, but people don't have the tooling to get there sometimes. Like, okay, what do I do? You know, but there is an example of, okay, you can just ask that question, and just everyone's had that situation where you felt rejected for who you are, no matter who it is that, you know, every single identity has had that. And therefore there's a human connection that we can all understand. And from there you can build. So yeah, more of these types of practical things will be useful. Okay, listen, I'm conscious of time, folks. I want to move swiftly on. So I'm going to thank Jesse and Africa for being with us, giving us the perspective from the non-HR side I'm going to bring in some other folks that are a little bit closer aligned to the HR and consultancy view to see what they think about it, because there's hugely motivated people on that side also that that also want to kind of move this into a operationalize it, if you like, across the business. So thank you very much, Jesse. Please hang around. We'd love to keep you in the chat there. And thank you, Africa. Same to you. I'll see you both soon, okay?
Thank you.
What interesting people and great examples of journeys that you can make. Some interesting things sort of come out of that, particularly the idea of like almost a parallel structure, right? So you've got the formal org structure in terms of function, like business function, you do this. And then there's like a parallel structure that is about the values. And that may actually kind of overlap or even cut across the hierarchy somewhat.
I'd love just to add really quickly, if I may. I love that last comment from Jesse about sharing a story where you felt rejected. 100%. That single nugget, how many senior leaders that rule these roosts are not owning that story?
100%.
I'm sure it's, that's a massive part of this.
Such a great, that's one of the questions I'm now going to put into the Brain Food Tribune, actually, because it is something that is, it's one of those where, you know, anybody can answer it and immediately you're going to go deep on it. So super interesting. Okay, well, we're going to bring on sort of some different perspectives here. Particularly, we're going to talk with, they're going to introduce themselves shortly. There's Katie, in fact. How are you doing?
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the invite. I'm very well, thank you. Can everyone hear me okay?
We can hear you fine. I'm sure everyone else can as well. So, Kadi, let's introduce you. Who are you and what it is you do?
Okay, so I'm really happy to be in this talk. I want to say that I've spent a couple of years already both in TA and diversity, inclusion and belonging space. I'm currently leading a talent acquisition team at the workshop globally. I'm based in Spain, although the focus is truly global around the world and is presenting a lot of challenges on a daily basis. And why I'm really excited about this talk is because I do believe TA and diversity, inclusion, equity, belonging is very correlated. And as TA professionals, we can actually do a great job of facilitating the discussion between the leadership, between the employees, and between the external world.
That's super interesting, Kati. Give me one sec. We're going to get Vessi on here as well in a sec. You know what? This relationship between the business and the TA or the people function, how would you think is the, like, it might just be my imagination that there's tension there, but how would you deal with a situation where there is ownership issues about DE&I? I mean, have you encountered that in the past, where there is someone who lays claim to it? You know, sometimes this stuff can get territorial, right? It's just the human nature to say, you know, this is my project. Have you encountered that situation? And if so, you know, what's the best approach?
Yeah, I think, you know, I didn't really enter, you know, a fight territory over the topic. It was more a question of, you know, groups of individuals and groups of departments wanting to do the job, not really knowing where to start, not laying the strategy from the beginning. And, you know, there was a lot of back and forth about, okay, here are some initiatives. How do they link back to, you know, the overall business strategy? How do they link back to, talent acquisition strategy? So one thing that I recently read, the biggest treat, for instance, for talent acquisition is the constant pressure. And we all know how much pressure there is to fill the roles quickly with, you know, profiles with amazing experience, while bringing also the diverse population. So there is a lot of topics you have to juggle, really. How to change that, how to go to that ownership. I don't have a very strong opinion in terms of, you know, should there be a chief diversity officer? Should there be one person? I'm rather on the side that, you know, as soon as the leadership team understands the importance, give you time, give you focus, ideally the budget to run with as well for certain initiatives, you have that direction. So how I like to work on those topics is, for instance, join those diversity resource groups, strategy groups, where people can contribute from their professional perspective. So for instance, marketing professionals can help very well in setting internal comms, external events, bringing in lightning talks. TA specialists, you can really map out your process. You can understand what to do better in terms of job descriptions, pipelining, anonymizing CVs. The leadership, hey, let's walk the talk. You want to have diverse representation? Look at yourselves. I have to say, currently, I'm in a really, really great position because the leadership team I work with is almost 50% female. There are people from different races, different countries, and it really makes such an amazing difference. Also ages, I forgot to say. So, you know, that's how I would approach it. I would always ask the leadership to give an importance to that. Because if you don't have that, well, I want to be blunt, but working for a company where the leadership team does not really pay attention to that, I wouldn't like to waste my efforts. I mean, it's a sad truth, but as a TA person, I can show the data, I can show feedback, and if no one listens to me, that's gonna be tough, right? So I'm gonna stop here, and maybe.
No, we'll definitely. Thank you very much, Kerry. It's really, you know, when you talk about the leadership angle, that's going to be one of the things that's really difficult to try and negotiate, because there probably isn't a leader right now that would willingly explicitly say they don't give a shit. It's like no longer able to articulate this. But that doesn't mean they don't hold that feeling, or, you know, it's not elevated at least in their priority list. In which case, you know, how do you identify that? I would hope, I'm an optimist, so I would hope there's a way in which people might be persuaded in some way. But I do recognize it suddenly becomes a lot more frustrating when, you know, there isn't that support at the top level or at various levels of the hierarchy there. Vessi, let's go to you on this particular topic, actually, because you do a lot of consultancy work for businesses. So presumably this is something that you might have come across before in the past. But before we do this, quickly introduce yourself, Vessi. Who are you and what it is you do?
Thanks for having me, Hung. Vessi, founder of Vessi.com. I work with clients across Europe, North America, like the likes of SoundCloud, Typeform. I don't work exclusively with tech companies. I actually really enjoy working with non-tech companies as well, because you know they might have different challenges.
I do want to talk about that, because we are so tech focused, and I think tech is just generally more liberal in terms of like social values, whereas a chemicals company or you know a mining company or something like that, that is good as a different play. They've been around in a different context and inevitably have a different demographic. Anyway, we'll go back to that, Vessi, sorry.
Yeah, so my background is in marketing, product strategy. So I speak the language of the business leaders, and I approach things in a holistic manner. So we work with the business, with the people, KPIs, and the culture. It's not, you know, just D&I, and that, you know, and that's it. So very much looking at D&I as something that is not in isolation of HR, but it's equally important for everything else.
How would you deal with this issue? The central premise of this show, Vessi, is, you know what, there's an ownership problem because DE&I may just belong or perceive to belong in a certain department. I'm saying that's potentially negative because it deactivates other employees. That might actually really help. And in fact, in the end, you do want to operationalize it across the business.
Yeah.
What have you encountered in your consultancy career? Have you seen this pattern exist, and has there been efforts to change it?
I think it's more of a matrix. So on the one side, we have, you know, should there be the chief diversity officer? You know, some people are pro, others can be against. There's many variations in between where people do it part-time or full-time and they don't have the authority or the budgets that hopefully diversity officers have. And on the other side, we have, you know, what Katie was saying, you know, to what extent is the leadership supportive? Because if they're not, if they don't see the value, like, what's the point? Everyone else is just trying to create impact for something that if it's not a priority, it becomes really hard. And yeah, most leaders would not say that they don't support D&I. And it's almost like 50 shades of leadership commitment to D&I. You know, the gray is just, it's overwhelming. And people try to do the right thing in how they talk. Saying that they support it and how deeply, deeply, deeply they mean it from their heart. And you need to almost have like a lie detector to understand what it is. It's like no one, you know, no one tells you. But you also need to understand where they are on that journey so, you know, we can bring them on board. It's not the responsibility of one person. So if a company is only doing it to, well, a leadership is doing it just to kind of like shift the responsibility and respectively the blame of why things are not advancing, it's a terrible strategy. And if someone is doing it for like PR purposes, the optics last like how much, like for how long, like maybe 2-3 months, people are very quick to pick up on the lack of authenticity.
There's a really interesting point that made by Gareth Jones. Gareth, thank you very much for this. By the way, I'm reading on my phone here because I don't have multi-screen. Quite poor, actually. He's mentioned diversity as it needs to be broad church, right? So not just only most prominent demographics that we talk about, gender, race, these days, I think also sexual preference. But what about things like different abilities in terms of physical mobility, even neurodiversity, things of this type? How does that kind of go into the mix when it comes down to operationalizing D&I? Like, does it make sense, for instance, to identify people that belong to a certain demographic in the population and say, right, I want you to help with this? Or is that like just putting too much on this person's plate? Like, they may just be working in a job. Maybe that's their focus. Maybe they don't actually want to be this like avatar of the business in this way. So how do we do that? Is it a good policy to approach people or that belong to an underrepresented minority in your business and have them do it? Is that okay to go and approach those folks?
It depends how it's done, right? Like, if you just push the one black person to the front row for the picture, you know, they feel like shit. They feel used. If you actually go and have this conversation and be like, you know what, this is such a white company, or, you know, respectively straight and, or, you know, able-bodied, etc. We want more people like you. Like, what should we do about this? I don't know the organizations. Maybe you know the organizations. How can we engage people? Are we doing enough right now, even like to accommodate your own needs? What is your experience? So I think it's a whole conversation of building trust and understanding this person's experience, and then getting to the point of, and how do you feel about championing this and be the face of our, you know, efforts for inclusion and belonging to show diversity and get, you know, more people from these demographics. I think many people will understand where this is coming from. For, you know, let's say the TA or, you know, whoever approaches it. But it's about, do we actually have that conversation, or do we just push them to the front row for that photo?
No, I love the fact you've given a structure there, Vessi, because it isn't just busting out with it, because it's like very intimidating, isn't it, to say you're now representing this group of people. What you want to do is firstly investigate whether you as a business are providing everything that's required for all your employees. And this is a general conversation everywhere, but it might emerge during the conversation with this individual that them being in a minority status in the business, let's cover that and say, hey, is this being catered for in some way? And then from there, that conversation might start emerging and that person might build a bit of confidence. And you can sort of read, you know, whether the motivation might be there, right? I mean, sometimes there'll be the person's not interested. I think that's fine. There's no reason why this individual should take that responsibility on. They want to just get on with their job in this fashion. Mm-hmm. Totally fine. But if you get the read that maybe they're interested in this, then yeah, maybe there's an opportunity there.
But you also said confidence. If someone has felt systematically excluded, then how can they be... How can they feel empowered to be the spokesperson?
Right.
Totally. Yeah, what I wanted to add, what would help, you know, avoiding, you know, being a token, which I hate, also being a woman in tech for many years, I just kind of refuse saying, no picture with me for any promotional materials. But if you have those diversity resource groups, if you create a safe space and a platform where people can join, I have many, many examples also in my current company that people would join those and say, well, I believe you don't do enough for certain demographics. And I would say, okay, we have a problem with 50 plus employees. Can we do something about it? And that's taken, you know, to the backlog and prioritized as a part of, you know, diversity strategy. So once you have that platform for people to speak up and it's supported again by some leadership team, that would be so much easier. So yeah, I think by having this framework where you can speak up or you can propose things, it's really helpful. And to the neurodiversity part, I just want to say that there is so many external partners in different countries. I don't want to say any particular one, but currently working in the UK and in Spain with different job boards, networks that reach out to people with various sort of neurodiversity profiles. It's really incredible how much talent pool you're missing out if you are not reaching out to this community.
Yeah, I think so. And you know what? I want to go back just to 2 seconds to what you said earlier about backlogs, Kadi, because I think that tells me that there's like a continuous improvement idea in this. So we talked when Jesse and Africa were on, we talked about, hey, maybe you just want to like a win, like a get a set piece project to just establish the space. But you know, perhaps there's an ongoing way in which you can keep sort of the diversity and inclusion a conversation going, but you can kind of start putting tickets in there. You can start saying, you know what, this is something that we need to look at. You have to organize the priorities in some way. So why not organize it in a Kanban board or organize it like a project fashion so that you can examine it in some way. And whether that is a resource group sort of that's parallel to the normal structure of the business or a formal structure that you might have, I guess it's up to the individual business. But yeah, having something like that may be useful. However, that does mean, it seems to mean that there should be someone owning that. Like, we're going to bring Rocky on in a second. She does have a job as diversity officer with her business. Do you think this is going to be like an emerging role, or do you think actually other people can have it, or should it just be like out there in the crowd? How does it work in terms of different models?
There is a 50% increase in chief diversity officer roles since June last year, so the growth is there. It is an emerging role, and it's very, very hard. I actually haven't seen a successful example where a company that has been struggling with diversity and inclusion manages to get substantial work done without having a team that is, even if most of their job is actually project management around this, because there are too many pieces. You know, you need to work with the marketing team, with the people team, with the leadership team, a lot of like trainers and facilitators, lots of consultants, like whatnot.
Well, you know what? It's basically, it needs to be understood also that people have jobs within the business that isn't related to this. So even though we're talking about, yes, you've got to operationalize it, it can sometimes take it away. I can imagine a scenario, let's say someone who's doing job X, but suddenly gets motivated to do activity Y, you know, maybe there's a performance gap at some point because there's so much time being spent doing this thing, which is super valuable for the business. But as doing the functional job that you've been employed for, that's declining. That's obviously a problem. So maybe you do switch full time into this activity. Maybe the business can facilitate that. But at some point, you know, there's a limitation to how much an in business person can do. Let's bring Rocky on, actually. I see no reason why not. If she's still with us, I was hoping to make sure Rocky was not like waking up too early. I'm very conscious of this. Oh, there's two Rocky Howards. That's a bonus. Let's see whether we can get the right one in. I think that's her. And I'd be fascinated to learn from this, especially as it's a very new role, comparatively speaking, but one that may be, you know, soon widely adopted because, as you say, 50% market-wide increase. Where did you get that data, by the way, Vessi? I'd be interested.
I was looking at some report today. I might be able to find it for you. I was going through some articles. I'll ping it in the chat.
Yeah, please do. Put it in the chat so everyone can see it. And there she is, Rocky Howard. How are you doing?
Happy Friday, team. It's nice to talk to everybody. There's been so much great stuff today, right?
It's been great. Great to be seeing you in the chat as well there, Rocky. You got up really early to have a chat with us. So thank you very much for that.
I tell you, I did inclusive leadership training before our time together today.
So. Did you really? Goodness me. I wouldn't work you that hard if you were working for me. I can tell you that. Let this lady sleep, you know? Anyway, Rocky, for the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, like who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, so I'm the Chief Diversity Officer at Smart Recruiters. And so my role is to work across our client base and support their diversity hiring success, in addition to working internally within our organization to make sure that we have a culture that the foundation is laid on equity, inclusion, and belonging. I'm also the host of the Voices of Diversity podcast. We've talked a lot today about humanizing diversity and creating those stories in those spaces. And that's exactly why I started that podcast, so that we let people who are in the world as underrepresented tell their stories. And it becomes part of a toolkit that you guys can use to say, hey, you don't understand this. Take 30 minutes and listen to this story about the person who is on the autism spectrum, or who's a Black leader, or who's a single mom, because I believe in the power of stories. And I believe that we can make progress with this issue, one story, one conversation at a time.
Yeah, amazing. Feel free to share the link to that podcast in the chat stream there, Rocky. I'm sure a lot of people watching this would be keen to investigate further. Tell me about the Chief Diversity Officer role from the internal context, Rocky, because as Vessi mentioned, quite a new thing, right? It's not like it's been around for 20 years. It's a new role. It's a new category. What's your experience of it as a job? Like, who are you interfacing with? Who are you talking to? What are your key individuals that kind of the levers in the business to make your initiatives work?
Yeah, I think Vessi had a really good point, and she articulated it very well. So let me be clear, and I've said this in the chat, I don't own diversity for my organization. We all do, okay? I am a facilitator in that process, and I'm a connector in that process. I do think that for Chief Diversity Officer roles to be successful, and look, guys, the 50% increase, some of that is marketing, right? It'll be really interesting to see 12 months from now how many people are still in those jobs and how many of those jobs still exist. I work for an organization that is completely committed. And so I have no worries about my job existing, right? But I also report to our CEO. And I think that's thing number one, that the Chief Diversity Officer has to report to the CEO and be empowered to drive diversity throughout the organization without the constraints of navigating politics at very different levels. So I interact with our CEO, I interact with our head of people, I interact with all of our senior leaders, I drive conversations throughout our organization. I work externally. So the scope of that role is pretty wide because you're talking to make impact. We need everybody to understand their role. And so I hope that answers the question. I could go on. I'm sensitive to time, but I could go on for hours, but I hope that answers the question.
We're gonna keep going for a little while. We're a little bit over, but there's no deadline on my side. If everyone is like needing to go, then don't sort of burn the toast or whatever. Please go sort that out. But there's enough people that we can continue the chat. Okay, so I think it's really cool because we've got a lot of like tech companies. But who's it, Vessi? I think it was you that mentioned the idea that actually there's different types of company out there. And then suddenly you have different types of challenge. And maybe when you have a legacy, it becomes a different sort of beast to move. It's like the difference between a speedboat and an oil tanker. You need a different pilot, a different skill set, and probably a different set of measures, right? Because you can't exactly blame an oil tanker for not turning as fast as a speedboat. So let's talk about this. Big, mature business. They think, yes, we need to diversify. We need to activate the employee base. How do we do that? Any quick ideas? Let's go for a quick round robin on this. Gary, let's start with you, actually. I haven't said anything for a while. What's your view on, we have lost Vessi. That's okay. The toast needs to be rescued. I get it. Butter that toast. You know,
I just need to grab my charger. I'll be back in a
sec. I actually insist on you coming back with a slice of toast now, Vessi. That image is in my mind. Okay, Gary, how do we operationalize? You got a big old company there. It's not your fault you're working for a 500-year-old company or whatever, you know. How do you kind of start the process? How do you get this message out to the wider group without being the person that is just like a complainer, so to speak? You know, you're like you're a person that's actually doing something positive and people can recognize that. Give me some like practical steps.
Practical step is experiment. Find your tribe and experiment. It's as simple as that. So it takes a bit of courage. So me as the white guy, I'm going out and saying, hey, I think this matters. Can we have a conversation? So it's one by one by one. It's not like it's big, like let's get 50 people in a room. Like it's relationships. Relationships, relationships, relationships. And it's taking ages, hon. But bit by bit by bit, people wake up and go, oh, let's look in that direction. I don't know anything. I'm the activator. I'm not the one that knows stuff. I'm the person who just connects and directs them towards resources. And that's what I think my role is. So,
yeah, that's really interesting. Let's sit on that for a little while. Maybe you can't boil the entire ocean in one go. You need to understand that the world can change with the small changes. In fact, big changes are made of small changes, right? And if you can just like have a chat with one person and give them a bit of guidance, I think most people generally feel the basic principles of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Most people, I think, would align with that. The question that Vessi mentioned about, you know, have you ever felt like isolated or excluded due to who you were? I think it's really powerful. Most people have that experience. Most people would not like to inflict that experience on others, I would hope. So potentially, you know, we can do a lot with small numbers. Let's go with you on this, Caddy. Give us like a practical example or a practical recommendation. I'm trying to activate more DE&I consciousness in our business. It's just a bit slow moving. It's a big one, you know, all business. How would you recommend we go ahead and do that?
I think I would agree with Gary. Experimenting, start small, but I would also start with me in a way. I'm not shy to give examples. You know, it takes courage indeed to talk, for instance, about the language that's used, because it's very powerful how you speak about diversity, how you speak to include others, how you also shape your own team. I just saw in the chat box how much importance it is, you know, the lack of diversity on TA teams. I mean, this is where we start. If I believe in the power of diversity, inclusion, and belonging, I'm going to structure the team in a way that I have very different representation on the team. And I'm going to talk about it to the leadership team, to other managers, till they are really bored of my talk. But they will see, look, this team is working. This team is doing great stuff. And maybe that's because they are diverse. Maybe because their leader is inclusive. Maybe because you know, they care about that stuff. So it's a lot about influencing. It's a lot about, you know, showing those positive business examples. And again, if they get it, that's great. You will have a business case. You will have a support. And if not, as they said, maybe time to change the company, change the approach, because also to the point of hiring chief diversity officers. On one hand, I was very happy to see that last year, but the other hand, I thought that maybe, you know, it's reactive. Maybe it's a quick fix that the companies are looking for just to put a person under those responsibilities. So I'm just still watching the space and thinking what's coming up. So yeah, that's my practical part.
Thank you, Kadi. I think it is an emergent space. So I think we just got to monitor it and see how we go and support as best we can. You made a very good point about the lack of diversity within TA and in HR on a wider space. There's no question about that. And that's always been the case, actually. It has always been an incongruent aspect of DE&I that the function that, you know, generally speaking, a topic of the show has been owning this. We're doing a poll, by the way. Does the poll agree? No, it doesn't. No, the poll does agree. 14, they're saying 43% of the poll respondees are saying DE&I is owned by HR, and then a similar number have said it's not owned by anybody. Regardless of that particular poll, though, TA and HR are hugely homogenous in different countries. In the UK, it's very female, for 70% female, something like this, very university educated, of course, more white than the general population stats would indicate. So you've got a very narrow band of people that dominate the conversation there. And why that is, I don't know. But is it a good thing to have that? Probably we could work on improving it if we care about genuine diversity throughout the rest of the business. A really good point there, Kelly. Okay, let's go with you, Vessi, on this. Give us a practical like recommendation. We want to change it. How do we do it in a doable way?
Which part, the TA team or in general?
Well, let's say you want to diversify the organization. You want to make sure more people are activated in the business. Mm-hmm. They feel empowered to go and do something rather than, you know, waiting for leadership from a particular department.
Yeah. Okay. So a couple of simple, doable things. One of them would be to work with partnership organizations. A good way to do that is to, let's say, we actually just had a call with a client yesterday with one of the so they're a talent tech company out of UK. They have an office in Bulgaria, and they want to hire more gay people. They're actually incredibly gay friendly, especially for the region. It's absolutely incredible. We were on a call with an LGBTQ organization out of Bulgaria, and one of the ideas that we were discussing was to have some of the employees get on calls with people who are interested in tech, or maybe interested in, you know, like, let's say marketing roles in tech, or product roles, or dev, or customer support, and be matched with, employees in those areas, and just have a chat. So it's more of an effort to establish trust and have those, like, you know, it's like mentoring before you even get to the stage of like applying or even joining the company, where people can get access to maybe an industry they don't know much about. You know, for many of us that are on Crowdcast or any of those events, we just know we can ping someone on LinkedIn, jump on a call, and, you know, and if the doors are not open, we will find a way to open the doors or find someone who can open those doors for us, right? But many people were not in this place for a variety of reasons. Education, access to resources, you know, their personality is not, you know, that, let's say, proactive or extroverted or whatever. And let's say in this specific case, like being gay, growing up in Bulgaria, it can impact you in many ways. It probably affects your confidence. Or even if it doesn't affect your confidence, you couldn't even think of the possibility of a gay-friendly company. So getting people in close proximity, maybe not physical at the moment, but digitally close, is a great way to do that. So on the one side, many companies want to have their employees volunteering, and or employees want to volunteer on a specific area. And on the other side, we have organizations who are happy to support with placements. So we keep both sides very active in this way.
You know what? That's a really important point, Vessi. Thank you for that. The proximity, I think, can solve a lot of those issues, because so often it is just a lack of awareness and a lack of exposure, right? I mean, I grew up in a part of the UK that was like very much a certain demographic. It was like 100% working class white. My cousin actually shared a school photo. And you know, 300 kids there, two non-white kids with me and him. But that was okay. You know, that was how it was. And I'm not complaining about that experience, but I can imagine, if you're working and living and always been in that type of environment, you might not feel equipped to have conversations of even this type, which are typically metropolitan conversations. Let's face it, right? We're comfortable big city folks. If you're working in a smaller town and you don't have these conversations. So finding a way to connect people from different communities and different life experiences, I think, is a critical way to do it. I think it aligned a little bit to your podcast, actually, Rocky, where you're exposing these stories from people who just may not know, but that's actually just enough to expose that so that they can explore it if they want. Okay, let's go to you, Rocky. Final thing, give us a quick tip. There's a couple of questions here we need to answer as well, but we're going to answer this one question from Rocky first, the one I'm going to ask you, and then we'll go to these questions properly. Quick tip for operationalizing DE&I outside of HR and in that department. Get it out of the business. What do you do?
I would stay with the theme of collaboration. And I think what happens is we get stuck. We're looking at all these checklists of what we should do to implement diversity in our organization. We want quick wins. We're so stuck in what's the metric, what's the KPI, what's the program, what's this? And then we get overwhelmed and we don't do anything. In the spirit of collaboration, what I would encourage you to do is to kind of take a step back and talk to your industry peers, talk to other organizations who are working on diversity, people who are willing to tell you the truth. What I have found is that this is not an issue we're going to solve individually. This is an issue we're going to solve collectively. And I have not met a DEI leader yet, whether they're a CDO or someone in the business who owns it, that isn't willing to have a conversation, talk about how difficult the work is, talk about how they started, and give advice. And so I think if you're looking for, I don't know where to start, talk to other people who have done it. They don't have to be the top of their game, but they've made some steps. And then take that information and look at what would work best within your organization.
You know what? Is there a resource where people can follow for this? Usually there's a brain food big list for it, but there isn't one in this particular case. So I wonder whether there is like a place where you can point to say, you know what, here are a bunch of people that do this. You know, maybe it's worth just connecting with those folks. If anybody knows, by the way, please share it with me either directly or in some sort of chat stream we're in. We're going to make sure everyone gets access to that. Okay, listen, we're out of time, folks. So I'm really sorry we weren't able to get to the questions we actually suggested we would do. And my apologies to the people who did ask those questions. We're just running out of time due to probably my bad chat. So I just want to thank everyone for watching. It's been a great show. Really learned a lot. So much to talk about as well. It seems that we've just scratched a little bit of the surface of this topic. And I'd love to revisit this in some other way. Maybe even do some DE&I initiatives within the brain food context. You know, what else can we do to make sure that's a little bit more prominent to that audience. So great to have everybody here. So thank you, Vessi. Thank you, Rocky. Thank you, Katty. Have a good weekend. We'll see you two. We'll see you three, should I say, hopefully very soon.
Thanks, Han.
I'll let you go. Have a good day. And thanks everyone for watching. It's been awesome having you. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Lots to think about. And more to talk about. We haven't even started the conversation, in my view, Gary. And I know there's a bunch of people watching that feel excluded, for instance. We haven't talked about, you know, lots of different populations that need to be part of this conversation. You're talking about sort of your own situation, Gary, as a white man. That's a different set of challenges to get involved in this chat. And then that's probably a topic for Brain Food Live in future, where we, you know, we cannot exclude at all any demographic, and white men absolutely need to be part of this conversation. So, you know, let's have a look at how we can make the situation comfortable for that to happen. Because I do know, and I can know actually from the direct messages I've received on my LinkedIn since the course of this conversation, there's a lot of people that don't feel comfortable speaking on these topics, because they don't come from an underrepresented demographic. And I think that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody needs to be able to speak on this, and everyone needs to feel comfortable. So if we haven't created that comfort level, something's gone wrong, and we need to fix that as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Brilliant. Let's leave it at that. Thank you very much, Gary. You have a very good day, sir. Thank you for helping
me. Thank you. Thanks,
Ron. If you've enjoyed this, follow the channel. We do this every Friday. Next week, we are talking about something even also interesting, although I forget the title of what it is. I think I know what it is. I'll be able to tell you in a second, actually. I believe it's something to do with remote working, but it's going to be a really exciting show. It is going to be, the dark side of LinkedIn, folks. The dark side of LinkedIn. Like, we talk about the alternative history, the alternative universe of it. But one of the things that's true on LinkedIn is that we're on it all the time. But some of us have a really bad time on LinkedIn due to bad behavior from, like, strange folks. Like, for instance, have you had a stalker? Have you had someone who's just followed you online and just constantly criticized what you posted? I have. Have you dealt with somebody who basically is super persistent and inappropriate in their messaging, or aggressive in some way? Again, that's happened to me. I remember some dude literally coming at me, offering me up for a fight. It was like, I'm pretty certain I've never spoke to you my entire life, digitally or in person. So where does this come from? So we're going to be talking about that. Like, what is the dark side of this? And how do we deal with it? What are the policy? Of course, there's a block option, but what else can you do? What do you do when you have an interaction that's difficult online in LinkedIn? Is there a way to turn it around? So make sure you follow that. It's going to be an amazing show, and hopefully we'll learn some interesting techniques on that. Cool. All right, that's about it, everyone. Have a good afternoon, good evening, a good day. We'll see you next week.
Cheers, Hong. Cheers, everyone.
Oh, we've kept 50 people on Crowdcast. That's amazing. Thanks for staying to the bitter end, folks. I know it's running a little bit longer. These shows are lasting longer than is the plan. I wonder whether they're more naturally a 90-minute or even two-hour type of affair. But 1 hour is basically what we're going to shoot for. All right, that's about it. Have a good weekend, folks.